The State versus Carver.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, my name is Oliver Davis, here for Mr. Carver. May I reserve 2 minutes?
All right.
Thank you. There are two issues presented. The first is the question whether the trial court abused its discretion in not ordering a new competency evaluation when there was reason to doubt Mr. Carver's competency. The second is whether Mr. Carver's waiver of his right to counsel at trial was knowing and voluntary, where he was misadvised of the maximum penalty. And I'd actually like to ask the court to consider reaching that second issue first, because unlike the competency question, it does not present the somewhat complex issue of what the appropriate remedy is, reversal or remand. What the court has before it is a copy of the original information in this case, and on the subsequent pages a copy of the amended information. And although the second information is entitled Second Amended Information, in fact there were only two charging documents filed in this case. The first one is the pertinent one, because Mr. Carver at the time in a bifurcated hearing on June 2nd and 17, when he waived his right to counsel, the pertinent charges were those stated in that first information, the Class C felony and two misdemeanors. Under 992080, the misdemeanors could have been run consecutive to themselves, and the felony, so Mr. Carver was facing a maximum penalty of 7 years, and that is the advisement he should have been given when the court was going through the Feretta colloquy with him on those 2 days. The court at the hearing on June 2nd and on June 17 also advised Mr. Carver of the penalties, or attempted to advise him that he was also charged with additional crimes, but those were only contemplated at that point. That's something of a moot point, however, because the distinguishing fact in this case is that Mr. Carver was told expressly at the first hearing on June 2nd, and then implicitly by the court verbatim setting out the same charges, that the penalty he was facing at trial was 32 years. And that's simply incorrect, no matter what combination of charges the court considers Mr. Carver to have been.
Even if incorrect, why is it prejudicial?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe there's any requirement that the defendant show that the misadvisement in the context of a Feretta colloquy, that he proved that it was material to his decision to waive his right to a lawyer. So, for example, in the plea context, where a defendant is misadvised of the penalty he'll face at sentencing, that voids the plea because it's an unknowing plea because he was misadvised. Whether that misadvisement was higher or lower than the sentence the defendant actually was going to face at sentencing. And essentially the respondent is asking this court to impose a requirement that the defendant show materiality when he is misadvised in one direction or the other as to the maximum penalty. And for the same reasons that our courts have been unwilling to impose a materiality requirement in the plea withdrawal context, the court should be unwilling to apply.
Shouldn't we treat this more like a clerical error in judgment and sentence? Because, as I recall the record, the court reiterated each of the offenses and the maximum for each, and was doing it in the context of they can be consecutive, and simply announced the wrong number. It's an addition problem in the court's announcement, not that your client wasn't actually told what the maximum for each of the offenses was.
Well, the defendant's entitled to be advised of the maximum penalty he'll face at trial if he proceeds to represent himself. And the math in calculating up what consecutive means and what that means with regard to adding up the maximum penalties on any individual count is quite complicated. The defendant was entitled to rely on the trial court's learned representation that the maximum penalty faced with this particular combination of felonies and misdemeanors that could be run consecutively was 32 years. The court was very clear. The penalty is 32 years. At the second part of the pro se colloquy or the Feretta waiver on June 17, the court repeated verbatim the listing of the charges that were faced, erroneously, because they weren't all instituted at that point, and repeated the statement that he'd made on June 2nd that these were to be run consecutive. And at the second hearing, didn't total that up to 32 years, but that was the same representation the court had made on June 2nd when it said that those same charges referred to a maximum penalty of 32 years. And, of course, those weren't the charges that Mr. Carver was facing on June 2nd or June 17. He was only facing the charges amounting to a 7-year maximum penalty that are shown in the first information. The second information, which charged an entirely different set of crimes, including malmischief third degree, was not filed until July 8, after he'd waived his right to counsel. So it would be impossible for this court on direct appeal to do anything but speculate as to what the effect of a correct advisement of the maximum penalty would be. And to suggest that materiality is something that the defendant has to show when he's misadvised is simply inconsistent with the requirement that the defendant execute a knowing waiver of his right to counsel, because this, just as in the plea context, is a risk management decision by the defendant, and this court can't conclude one way or the other what the defendant might have done had he been advised correctly. Certainly one could argue that a defendant who was over-advised might have concluded, because he was told that he was facing 32 years, that he was effectively on trial for his life, and, well, he'd better darn well handle it himself instead of having an attorney do it. But again, that's speculation, and I would ask the court not to establish a new rule requiring the defendant to show materiality when he's misadvised in the Feretta context. On the question,
what is the case? What do you think is the key case that says that in a Feretta colloquy, a misadvisement of maximum is?
I cited Rochester, which is a Ninth Circuit federal case, in my reply, Your Honor. In that case, the government made the same argument. The defendant had been told in the Feretta colloquy that he was facing life, when in fact the actual maximum he was facing was 20 years. The government argued that the overstatement didn't matter because the defendant surely would have also waived his right to a lawyer if he'd been told that he was facing a smaller, a lighter sentence. And the Ninth Circuit rejected that.
But we don't have any Washington authority. I mean, I guess this usually comes up in a plea.
Yes. No Washington authority regarding that I can find regarding an overstatement of the maximum penalty, but the fundamental rule is that in order to be constitutionally valid, a waiver of the right to counsel must be knowing. That is, the defendant must have the pertinent facts at hand. And in this situation, the pertinent fact is a correct advisement of the maximum penalty faced.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Excuse me.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Donna Wise, representing the State of Washington. I will address first this issue of the Feretta advisement. And I think you have it exactly right, Judge Applewick. This was an error in addition that the judge made. He correctly stated the maximum penalty for each of the crimes charged. I don't know whether there was an initial amended information and not a second amended information. This argument that there was no amended information and the charges were inaccurate is first presented here to this court. I will go back and look at the record and determine that. I did look at my notes of the hearing, and the prosecutor at that hearing represented that there were two felony charges, felony harassment and felony stalking, and the state intended to add an additional felony charge of felony malicious mischief. And that's where the court got the three felonies and the two misdemeanors, the violation of no contact order. I think it's perfectly appropriate for the court to advise the defendant of what charges he will be facing at trial and not simply the charges that actually exist at the time of the warning, as long as it's clear that that's what the judge is saying and that was clear at that hearing. the state is going to add in charge.
Is it clear that it suffices that if the court names the crime and the maximum penalty for that crime, that's all that's required, as opposed to when you're accumulating multiple offenses, being accurate about the maximum offense for the combination?
Your Honor, when the actual penalty for each crime is perfectly clearly stated at that hearing, I think the error in addition is irrelevant. But in this case, that's not all that happens.
We have concurrent and consecutive options. We have exceptional options.
Well, in fact, all the judge is doing is advising of statutory maximums. So it's always an addition of all the counts, because technically consecutive terms is always possible. No one went into any calculation of what the possible standard ranges might be or anything like that, and that's not the requirement for advice on a Feretta hearing, because the point of a Feretta hearing is to advise the defendant of the seriousness of the consequences of the trial, and that's what was happened here. But the point I was going to make was this June 2nd hearing, when the addition error occurred, was not the last hearing. At the June 17th hearing, the continuation of that pro se motion, the court clearly said it's 5 years for each of the felonies, $10,000 fine, 1 year for each of the gross misdemeanors, $5,000 fine, did not attempt to add them together, did not provide any misstatement of what adding 5 + 5 + 5 + 1 + 1 is. I don't think that's complex math.
Do you think that the Ninth Circuit case that counsel referred to is correctly decided, and one that we should consider as good law and, in your view, distinguish it, or do you think that it's not correctly decided?
Your Honor, I think it's correct. I wouldn't dispute it's correct, but I would note the facts in that case are substantially different. For one thing, what the court advised the defendant was that he had a 10-year mandatory minimum, that his sentence was a 10-year mandatory minimum to life. The reality was his sentence that he possibly faced was 0 to 20 years. That is a significant difference, and the court focused on the mandatory minimum. The other thing is, that was never corrected. It wasn't an addition error. That was a statement of the actual penalty for the crime. It was wrong. It was never corrected. In addition, that defendant wasn't advised of one of the charges against him at all. He wasn't told of a conspiracy charge. So the court also relied on that in concluding that the Feretta advice was inadequate. Again, in this case, not only the motion on the pro se request was over two dates, June 2nd and June 17th. The court correctly stated the the maximum penalty for each count at the second hearing. And when the court did so, if you look at the transcript, he says to the defendant, "Do you understand?" The defendant says, "Yes." He understands the maximum term for each felony is 5 years, and the maximum term for each gross misdemeanor is one. He explicitly says he understands. After that, he waives counsel, and that motion is granted.
I think the more troubling question is, does he need to understand the maximum incarceration he's facing from all the charges and all the implications of the sentencing statute?
I think he did. I think my point, Your Honor, is that he did. On this record, he did understand what he faced. The court, again, in the second part of the hearing, said that those terms could run consecutively. That an addition error is exactly like a clerical error. It's not significant to the defendant's understanding. He never expressed any confusion. Again, at the trial, when the trial court, a different judge, tried to confirm that he still wanted to proceed pro se, the defendant said, "Yeah, I understand. The penalty for the felonies is 5 years on each count." There's no confusion there. The defendant understood perfectly well, and the judge's error in addition is not critical. Your Honor, I would like to respond to some claims that Mr. Zappi, who we are calling Carver, makes in his reply brief. Mr. Zappi argues that both attorneys, in this case the prosecutor and the defense attorney, requested an evaluation of the defendant for competency at the time of trial. This is the state's position that neither one of them did. You have to obviously look at this record, and the issues are addressed many times throughout many hearings, so it's difficult to parse it out. But I believe it's perfectly clear that what the prosecutor is requesting at the time of trial is a colloquy with the defendant to determine if there's a reasonable reason to doubt competency, which would warrant an evaluation. And in the appellant's reply brief, they refer to that as a nuance, I believe, but that is a significant legal distinction. The prosecutor did not say, I have a reason to doubt his competency. She asked the court to address the defendant to determine that. And that decision of the court is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. At that same hearing, the court said, Judge Gonzalez said to the defense attorney, I'm going to talk to the defendant. Do you have any particular, do you have any specific concerns? I believe the judge asked, do you have any specific concerns? And Mr. Mr. Carver's defense attorney said, I have no particular concerns. That is not a statement of a defense attorney who is asking for an evaluation of competency. I also want to address the defense statement that the defendant had no expert evaluation himself of his competency. If you look at, and I've indicated this in my brief, the sequence of events in February, the defense attorney at that time, Ms. Kim, asked for a continuance so her expert could conduct a competency evaluation. At the next hearing in March, she said, my expert has completed the evaluation, and now we're going to stipulate that the defendant is competent. That, to me, is perfectly clear that the defense expert evaluated the defendant's competency and concluded that he was competent. And then the court made the finding of competency at that date in March. Again, if you look at the transcripts in May and in June, the prosecutor says in a June hearing, I asked the defense attorney if she, if there was any reason to get an additional competency evaluation at the last hearing we had. She said no. Now, the last hearing that's transcribed is in May. So apparently, and this was not contradicted by the defense attorney at the June hearing, as of May, the defense attorney had no competency concerns. Now, the defense attorney who does say he has concerns is a new attorney who appears for the first time in June. And he says, I have grave concerns about the defendant's competency. But my expert, who has now evaluated the defendant again, this time for competency to represent himself, my expert says that she believes he is competent, not only competent to proceed, but to represent himself. I have concerns. But what's interesting to me about that is that that attorney, Mr. Palmer, is the attorney who a month and a half later has been acting as standby counsel with Mr. Carver and says to the trial court, Judge Gonzalez, I've been working with him for a month and a half. And that's when he says, I have no particular concerns. To me, at that point, a judge who then proceeds with a colloquy with Mr. Carver at some length, asking him about what they're doing in court, what the proceedings are going to involve, the judge does not abuse his discretion at that point in finding that there's no reason to doubt the defendant's competency. I would make also one legal point in response to the reply brief, and that is the defense attorney's argument that the Ortiz standard is once competency has been determined, it won't be reevaluated unless there's new evidence, a change in circumstances. And the defense attorney argues that that should be evaluated from the date the report is written from Western State Hospital. And that's not what Ortiz says. Ortiz says the status quo ante point, the point from which we determine whether there has been a change, is when competency was determined, the competency hearing, which of course makes sense. Has there been a change since competency already was determined? And in this case, that was in mid-March. Unless the court has any other questions, I'd ask the court to affirm the conviction and sentence. Thank you.
The first hearing on the waiver of right to counsel on June 2nd, the court stated the maximum penalty for the felonies is 5 years. The maximum penalty for the two gross demeanors is 1 year. 1 year. In some circumstances, those sentences could be made to run consecutive, so you are looking at 32 years in prison. Do you understand? Yes, I do. That is page 31 of the June 2nd transcript. At the continuation and completion of the Feretta colloquy hearing on June 17th, the court said exactly the same thing, 5 years for felonies, 1 year for misdemeanors. They could be run consecutive. Do you understand? Yes, I do. The applicable number that he was advised with in that two-part hearing was 32 years, and that was incorrect. Unless the court's going to establish a new rule of materiality in the Feretta context, which what I would argue is completely inconsistent with the rule that the defendant's waiver must be intelligent and knowing. The court, I believe, is compelled to reverse. On the competency issue, this is a question where the original competency report came with a huge caveat. He's basically competent right now, but he's got schizophrenia and a psychotic disorder, and it turns out he's not taking the medications that have ameliorated his condition in the past. On May 4, we learn 5 months later, in fact, that he is not taking medications in jail. They're not giving them to him. On June 2, the prosecutor very emphatically says to the court, this competency determination is 7 months old, and I'm concerned the defendant is decompensating based on the statements he's been making in court. On June 17, the prosecutor, having been unsuccessful previously, emphatically raises the issue again, and defense counsel then joins that request. I would say that defense counsel's joinder of the request is really the least factor. The prosecutor, based on all of these circumstances, is asking for a new hearing. If there's reason to doubt competency, the 1077 procedures and expert evaluation are triggered, and the court abused its discretion here. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next case, State versus